I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcast.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV Plus.
Welcome to the Bloomberg P&L Podcast. I'm Paul Sweeney, along with my co-host, Lisa Abramowitz.
Each day, we bring you the most noteworthy and useful interviews for you and your money, whether you're at the grocery store or the trading floor.
Find the Bloomberg P&L Podcast on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts, as well as at Bloomberg.com.
I'm Alex Steele in for Lisa Abramowitz today. Don't leave your powder dry. That was a takeaway from the market from New York Fed President John Williams speaking yesterday, and then things got really confusing. The New York Fed walks it back. President Trump tweets that the Fed's got to stop with crazy quantitative tightening. Here to help us make sense of it all is Marvin Lowe, global macro strategist for State Street. What did you literally make of the last like 10 hours from Fed talk?
You know what? I think we can get a sense of how challenged the communication process is for the Fed. That's the main thing. They're cutting 25 at least. I think there's a moderate reason to think that it might be a little bit more, but really the fact that they put it out there and they didn't realize that it was going to have that big of an impact on the market and need to walk it back just shows that the communication process that they've had since the beginning of the year, late last year, is still an issue.
So Marvin, again, as Alex was mentioning, President Trump is out with a number of tweets this morning about the Fed, about their next actions. Just give us a sense, how do you think the Fed deals with all this noise coming from the president as it relates to their policymaking?
You know, I mean, Chairman Powell, you know, ultimately laid it out when he went in front of Congress. You know, they can't ignore it, but ultimately they have a mandate. They report to Congress, and I think that they do go back and lean upon that. Having said that, the amount of pressure that Chairman Powell must be facing is intense. So I wouldn't say that they can completely ignore it, but, you know, they do have the side of their mandate to help them guide through that process.
I'm also really interested in the interplay between the Fed and the ECB, sort of like officially and then unofficially. I feel like it's who can get to the bottom first, who can be more dovish, how can they influence their currency the most. What kind of pressure is Mario Draghi going to feel on Thursday?
Yeah, so, you know, he's certainly looking towards how he wants his legacy to end.
He's looking towards retirement. He is. It's a vacay. That's what he wants.
He is, and we're all jealous of him for that. I think the Fed, you know, certainly has more room to move in this process. That's something that the market's been focused on. And the ECB will be happy to wait for the Fed to make its first move. And then all the other central banks are going to, you know, have the all clear to kind of move in the same direction.
So Marvin, at State Street, we're talking about Europe here, but at State Street, as you think globally, you know, we think about the economies in Europe being, you know, slowing dramatically, weakening. Yeah. Even Germany's showing signs of weakness.
Absolutely.
How are you guys thinking about allocating assets to Europe in general?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's part of the asset allocation process, no doubt. You know, it's a global world. You need a certain amount of assets within there. I think it's a function of how you want to move around the benchmarks. And the European challenges are out there, whether it's from a growth perspective, whether it's from their banking system, whether it's from the fact that the ECB just doesn't have as many bullets. Ultimately, if we are going towards this more looser type of environment, and, you know, do you really want to put an excess amount of your allocation there? And it's hard to see wanting to overweight it more than your benchmarks.
So when it comes to the bond market, I mean, do you feel like we've topped out, that we're at the peak of where bond prices can be in Europe?
We're certainly getting there. I think that the ECB has already signaled that it's willing to go further into negative yields, even if it does cause more problems for the banking system. But it can't go that much further. You know, the Fed certainly has much more room if we need to go there. I wouldn't say that yields here can't go lower, but certainly kind of the relative movement between U.S. yields and really the rest of the developed market yields is a different type of profile.
So Marvin, bringing it back to this side of the pond, we're starting to have some more discussions, or more heated discussions, about the debt ceiling. How do you think that plays out over the next couple of weeks, I guess, is kind of the time framer?
Yeah, you know, it's certainly good that they're talking about it now. I, however, am probably a bit skeptical that they can get anything done. So, you know, I would think that we're going to talk about September again, and we'll talk about all of the measures that might be needed.
So trying to get something done before Congress leaves for the summer vacation, you think the odds there are pretty low?
You know what? The fact that they're talking about it is positive. I'm just skeptical based on how our government has kind of functioned. If it does get done, it's great. There would be a lot of short-term issuance because the checking account of the U.S. government has been drawn down as we've been in this debt ceiling. But it winds up being more of a short-term kind of market type of issue. I don't think it's ultimately disruptive.
So when is markets actually going to care?
About the debt ceiling?
Yeah. Or just the amount of debt that, like, we're going to have to issue to pay off a deficit.
Two different stories there, certainly.
The
market will care if we get to September again and we have all these dire warnings that they're not going to be able to pay their debt and the rating agencies get involved. I don't expect they'll come to an agreement. In terms of longer term with yields where they are now, I think investors are willing to look past the fact that we're going to have these record amounts of debt. I'm not a MMT advocate, but at this point, there is demand for treasury yields, and we've certainly seen that as we kind of push towards these lower levels.
Where is the MMT argument or discussion these days? I haven't heard about it recently.
Wait, do we have to define it? Like, are we at the place where we don't have to define it anymore because it's like that vernacular?
Modern monetary theory.
Yeah.
Basically, it says what and... What does it say, and where are we with it?
It, you know, effectively says that governments can issue as much as they want, and we don't really have to worry about it, and you can run big deficits and finance whatever you want, and there's always going to be a buyer for it. You know, certainly the increase in debt that we've seen over the last couple of years makes one believe that that might be true, but you can't issue debt forever. You do crowd out. You do create an environment where zombie companies are allowed to go on longer. There are costs to the economy. When we get to the point where productivity growth and overall growth is gets to a new normal and people worry about it, the amount of debt is going to be part of that discussion.
Yeah, I'm just not buying it. I'm in that camp that's just not buying it, but we'll see. Marvin Lowe, global macro strategist, State Street, based in Boston, but joining us on our Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studio, talking all things Fed and all things economics. Of course, the Fed meets at the end of July. Markets certainly looking for at least a 25 basis point cut. This is Bloomberg. Well, consumers worldwide continue to debate energy sources, including fossil fuels, nuclear, and sustainable sources such as wind and sun. To get the latest insight on how nuclear power fits in, we turn to Seth Gray, President and CEO of Lightbridge Corporation, based in Reston, Virginia. Seth, thanks so much for joining us. Just wonder if you could give us an update on kind of the status of nuclear power in the U.S. right now.
Well, nuclear power has been kind of flat, hasn't been growing, hasn't been falling much, has been producing about 20% of the nation's electricity for some time. And now we're coming to something of an inflection point. Are we going to keep renewing the licenses of the old plants? Will we build more of those? Or are we going to move forward to newer technologies for fuels that could really upgrade those older reactors and deploy newer, more advanced technologies? And we have 98 plants in this country out of 450 in the world. China and Russia are moving aggressively to take the lead around the world. And the U.S. is now taking some very serious steps in Congress, in the administration, and in the companies to make sure that the U.S. competes and does very well in those international markets, which feed through supply chains to manufacturing all across America.
So we've definitely had the Trump administration in some ways want to backstop coal and nuclear because they want a reliable source of energy that sort of stays in storage versus, say, solar and wind. Is that a legitimate argument? Like, do we really need to backstop nuclear, or should we just let market forces kind of work their way through the system?
Well, it's a very legitimate argument to give value to it. What you can do at a coal plant for a period of months, and you could do at a nuclear plant for a period of many years, is have enough fuel on the site to run that plant 24/7. So nuclear reactors can run 24/7, even if trucks or trains can't deliver any fuel to the plant. Of course, the renewables can't run when the sun isn't shining, the wind isn't blowing, and need to be backed up by natural gas, which relies on gas flowing through the pipelines that could be cut off. So for unquestionable electricity delivery 24/7, you really do need nuclear and or coal. Nuclear, for a much longer period, could provide it, just as it powers our submarines for years. They could stay underwater, or our aircraft carriers, because they have nuclear reactors. You know, try that with wind power. So I think it's a legitimate argument to give value to reliability of the electric grid with nuclear power.
So, Seth, you mentioned some newer technologies that need to come into the nuclear power play. Give us a sense of what some of those technologies are, maybe kind of where your company fits in.
Right. So Lightbridge is developing a new nuclear fuel that will work in the existing reactors and new ones. The project just recently received its first U.S. Department of Energy grant to support the project and help take it forward. Our fuel technology is going to make the existing reactors much more economical by increasing the power that comes out of the plants, running the plants even longer between refuelings, dramatically improve the safety, running about 1,000 degrees Celsius, about 1,600 degrees Fahrenheit cooler than the fuel and current reactors, and also dramatically enhance proliferation resistance so that nothing could ever be used in a weapons program. And also part of the future of nuclear is the smaller reactors. The lead there is a company called NuScale, and we're starting to work with NuScale to bring our fuel to their smaller reactors, which I think will really be the lead in the next generation of nuclear reactors deployed here and around the world.
And a big part of that is obviously cost. Can you walk me through, like, how much it costs to, say, build a new plant, maintain your current plant, and then build the modular fleet, basically?
Yeah. Well, basically, the costs of building plants are very expensive when they're first of a kind. And then after you build about six or nine of them, you're at what some people call nth of a kind. You know what they're going to cost going forward. So one of the plants that was designed in the U.S. By the company that's now Westinghouse and is being deployed around the world, the Koreans are working with Westinghouse deploying in Abu Dhabi, makes 1,400 megawatts of electricity. That's a ton of power. Costs about $5 billion to build. That's a pretty solid number. You could build those kind of reactors or other similar ones for about $5 billion. On what you'd call a levelized cost of electricity out over the cost of the plant, that is cheaper than coal. That works very well over time. It's obviously a very big upfront cost, but then your fuel costs for 60 years or even 80 years are very low.
Seth, you mentioned earlier kind of some of the new technologies that could ensure or heighten non-proliferation of some of this nuclear technology. And we've got some issues with Iran right now. Give us a sense of just kind of the global deployment and the safety around deploying nuclear technologies globally.
Yeah, so first on Iran, they've suspended some of their obligations under the nuclear deal. They're enriching uranium a little bit higher than they're supposed to. They're making a little bit more of it than they're supposed to. They could easily step back and go back under those limits. They're trying to get European countries to help them work around U.S. sanctions, which I think are being very effective on Iran. So that's not really too great a worry on Iran yet. I think it's more of a negotiation dance of them with Europeans. Nuclear reactors deployed by major companies under safe licensing regimes like the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission are the safest way of generating power in the world. Nobody has ever died from radiation from anything in the reactor in the history of the U.S. power and nuclear power industry. Even at Fukushima, as great an industrial disaster as that was, nobody died from anything nuclear. People died from an earthquake. People died from a tsunami, but actually not from anything in the reactor. So it's a very safe technology. And in terms of proliferation, the way it's handled under the International Atomic right. Energy Agency oversight is very well done.
Got
and
it.
With Lightbridge's fuel, it will be even much more non-proliferative.
Understood. Seth Gray, thank you so much for joining us. Seth is president and CEO of Lightbridge Corporation based in Reston, Virginia. Very interesting as we think about how different technologies are deployed globally.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
Well, Boeing is back in the news. The company plans to report a $4.9 billion accounting charge related to its beleaguered 737 MAX jetliner. And the company also said that the plane would return to service in the fourth quarter, easing fears that the timetable could slip into next year. To dig a little deeper, we welcome our next guest, George Ferguson. George is a senior analyst covering aerospace, defense, and the airlines for Bloomberg Intelligence. He joins us on the phone from Bloomberg Intelligence headquarters in Princeton, New Jersey. George, thanks so much for joining us. The stock's up about 3.7% on the news here, so I guess shareholders like this?
Yeah, I think you're right, Paul. I think it starts to put a cuff or a back limit on when we think we see this airplane back in service. And it gives investors a number that they can look at for what the cost is going to be. I mean, I think that they're probably being conservative in the date the airplane reenters service. I think Boeing doesn't want that date to slip, and at least the date that they've provided. So my guess is they're probably fairly confident that the airplane gets back in service. That's in line, I think, with expectations that were in the marketplace for late 3Q, early 4Q reentry to service. The cost of the airplane being out of service was a little bit higher than we expected at Bloomberg Intelligence. I think that Boeing probably, again, put a conservative number together here, so it's probably bigger than even they expected. And they detail it's not going to be all cash, so it's not going to be all $4.9 billion in dollars. There'll be other types of concessions they offer customers, and it'll be over an extended period of time. And so I think now investors have a little more clarity around that, and that's part of what you're seeing today.
I feel so skeptical. I got to be honest with you. I feel like it's like, what? Sure, I want to win the lottery. It's kind of the same thing. But let's pretend. Let's pretend that this is correct. Boeing's estimates are correct. Things get fixed in the fourth quarter. What's not accounted for in the numbers, as in litigation or compensation for airlines, et cetera?
Yeah, so I mean, as I read it, it looks like the compensation for victims wasn't in that. And we think that's a pretty knowable number. It's, we think there's maybe $1.5 billion worth of potential cost to victims. But that kind of litigation can drag on for years, and it's a discussion about what the value of people are, which is a bit of a macabre discussion. But I don't think there's a lot more that's overhanging because of this grounding. Unless the grounding gets extended.
So, George, let's talk about the 737 MAX itself. Do you expect this the next time you go to London Air Show or the Paris Air Show? Do you think Boeing's going to have success in the years ahead selling this aircraft?
I do. We've seen key customers that have come out supporting the airplane. I think the IAG letter of intent at Paris was huge. And people like Willie Walsh, the IAG CEO, and Ryanair CEO have come out and endorsed the airplane. That's a strong endorsement. So I think that this has definitely been a difficult period for Boeing. But once they get this airplane back in the air, provided they have no other problems, that I think, look, they've really poured over this airplane now. My guess is that this will fade within 6 months or so.
What's going to be the holdup? Is it going to be getting past regulators, compliance? Is it going to be the actual fix itself?
So I don't think – I think the bigger challenge here will be to sell it to global regulators. And I think that the IAG sale was part of that fix. And I think it'll be – they'll look for airlines in the different regions to apply pressure to regulators to at least review the airplane so that it can re-enter service. I think IAG probably got a pretty good price, and so they'll be incented to go to the European regulator and say, hey, take a look at the airplane, tell us what they've got to do to re-enter service. I really think that the FAA has pored over this airplane now because they don't want their credibility, you know, further damaged. And so I think given the intensity the FAA has probably put into the review, I think Boeing ought to be in good shape to get it flying in the U.S. and in Europe pretty quickly thereafter, because I think the Europeans also, they don't want to separate this regulatory regime that has sort of relied on each other's, you know, each different jurisdiction's regulator. I think everybody in the aviation industry doesn't want to break that regime where you can rely on regulators in the different regions. And so I think the Europeans, without a real strong reason not to take the airplane back, will resist or delay.
George Ferguson, thank you so much. George is a senior aerospace, defense, and airlines analyst for Bloomberg Intelligence, joining us on the phone from Princeton, New Jersey. Will you get on a 737
I was literally going to ask you that question.
The answer for me is yes, without hesitation.
Like, I think so, but like I think I have to take a moment. I don't think I'd take my kid on it.
Interesting. I just feel like, you know, by the time this thing gets in the air, it's going to be the safest plane in the air, given what it's had to deal with. Let's head over now to Nathan Hagen, our 99.1 studios in Washington, D.C., to get a check on world and national headlines. Nathan. Focus on Munis is brought to you by Build America Mutual. BAM Green Star Bonds finance projects that protect and restore the environment with more renewable energy and efficient transportation and buildings. Visit buildamerica.com/greenstar. BAM, Building America. When we talk municipal bonds, I love to talk about the Puerto Rican market. It continues to make news. Looks like Puerto Rico is seeking to restructure about $27 billion of obligations tied to the central government and its main utility. To get the latest, we welcome our good friend Joe Mysak. Joe is editor for Bloomberg Brief for Bloomberg News. He joins us here in our Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio. Joe, what is the latest on this ever or never-ending saga of the Puerto Rican debt situation?
Riots in the streets.
Oh, no.
This week it was riots in the streets.
Yes, it was.
The, you know, the restructuring will go on at some point. But right now, the population is restive. That's the only way to describe it.
And what are they protesting, per
They are protesting almost 900 pages of chats that the governor was having with his various aides. And, you know, sometimes pretty salty stuff. And in general, protesting, you know, the incompetence of government at the, on the island for years and corruption. So, you know, it eventually it just blew up. So who knows whether the governor will be able to survive it. However, the restructuring goes on. And of course, this being the muni market, prices of Puerto Rico bonds were unchanged.
Well, I was going to say, so I subbed for Lisa, I don't know, what, 2 months ago on a Friday? And Joe, you were here and literally had this exact same conversation. So like what's a time frame that he's looking at me funny when I say that?
Certainly. You know, we're going to have resolution of this certainly this year. So I would, you know, what is that? Another 4 or 5 months. I know the oversight board is going to put their plan on the table in about a, you know, within the next several weeks.
And there's also $50 billion or so that the government owns or owes for retirees and things like that. So I mean, this is far from over as it relates to the overall finances of Puerto Rico. This you're talking about just some of these bonds that have been in default.
Right, just the bonds. The $50 billion figure you cite is, you know, what's owed to retirees. And Puerto Rico didn't do a good job with its pension fund, which is now at zero.
So I know that Paul loves Puerto Rico, and he knows that I love PG&E. So I want to talk about what's happening with PG&E, their bond, sort of where California is in trying to restructure their debt, have a liability fund.
You know, California passed legislation to set up a fund for the utilities to take advantage of in case there are more raging wildfires and, you know, they have, you know, rather than having the utilities go broke, they would be able to tap this fund. But the legislation also contains some impediments, or it's not as perfect as it might be to allow municipalities to buy parts of the utilities, and especially PG&E. San Francisco wanted to buy part of it. And they said, hey, you have to go back in and tweak this law for us, California. And it looks like the lawmakers there are constructive on this. They say they might go back in and do this.
Alex, have you ever been to the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas?
Oh, I have.
Have you ridden the monorail from the convention center to your hotel?
I don't remember. It was a long time ago and I was miserable.
Yes.
That sums up CES for you.
Exactly. Well, this famed monorail, which not that many people use, is the that's the problem for the monorail. They had a little problem with their municipal debt, didn't they, Joe?
Oh, wow. What a story. This is obviously the story of the week.
Great response.
Monorail sold $650 million in bonds in 2000 and it was to acquire the system and expand it, which they did. And in 2008, they tapped the reserve funds. In other words, went into default. And in 2010, they went into bankruptcy. 2012, they emerged from bankruptcy after wiping out 98% of the bondholders' principal. So they wound up owing $13 million. And this week, they paid off that $13 million, which means they're ready to come back to the municipal market. Can you believe it? Alex, believe me, if you had been on the monorail, you would have been cheered up. Because it's nice on the monorail. It's like, well, you're a little
I don't tired. Know. I had literally just flown in from Paris and then to New York to Vegas. Like, I didn't know what time it was. But what's the demand going to be like? And what does the Fed have to kind of say about it?
Oh, man.
Think about it that way.
You know, what? What is demand going to be? I'm a lot of angry people who say this is insane. This is a perfect example of how frothy the municipal market is. And in other words, there'll be lots of demand.
Exactly. Well, I don't know. I mean, having been at CES, the cab lines are like forever. The monorail is a good option.
So why does no one use it?
I don't know. Well, it's a car culture out. You know, it's a car culture, right?
Well, see, now this is part of the plan, or the monorail would definitely like to extend to the airport, but the cab industry is dead set against it.
Right.
So, we'll see where this expansion plan goes and if they're ever able to tap the market again. But there is a small deal on the Bloomberg calendar.
For the deal.
For the deal.
Okay, we'll see. Joe Misek, Bloomberg editor in for the Bloomberg Brief for the Municipal Markets, covering all things munis for us, joining us here in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studio. I don't know. I'm going to stick with the monorail. I mean,
well, specifically. Makes sense. You're making good sense of it.
Especially during CES, because literally the lines for the cabs at the hotel and they're just forever.
They need that in Davos.
They need that. Well, I think they need just like a sleigh.
They need something in Davos.
So we'll see. But we'll see if they can, in fact, if Las Vegas Monorail can come back to the market. We'll be on that story. This is Bloomberg.
Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg P&L podcast. You can subscribe and listen to interviews at Apple Podcasts or whatever podcast platform you prefer. I'm Paul Sweeney. I'm on Twitter at PT Sweeney.
I'm Lisa Abramowitz. I'm on Twitter at Lisa Abramowitz 1. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.